Hello and welcome to this latest Fraser of Allender podcast. This week we've published our quarterly economic commentary, which sets out our latest views on the outlook for the Scottish economy, what might happen next year as we recover, hopefully, from the COVID crisis. And also we set out some analysis about how different sectors may be impacted by COVID and Brexit in different ways. Alongside our Fraser of Allender economic commentary, we also published our Scotland's Budget Report 2020. And this looks ahead to the Scottish Budget at the end of January and the sort of difficult decisions Kate Forbes might have to make in deciding how to support the recovery, which is likely to be a little bit of a bumpy ride, particularly after we leave the transition period at the end of December. So joining me on the podcast today is Hannah White, who is the Deputy Director of the Institute for Government. I've been involved in some discussions with Hannah in the past, and I've always found her insight from a kind of Westminster perspective really interesting, looking from that perspective at devolved budgeting and how the different governments of the UK are working together. So I asked her to join me today to talk through some of these issues. Thanks for joining me today, Hannah.
Hello, nice to be on your podcast.
So just for our listeners who might not be aware, do you just want to say a little bit about what the Institute for Government is and what you try to do?
Yeah, sure. So the Institute for Government's been around about 11 years now, and we were set up as a non-partisan think tank based in Westminster to think about ways to make government more effective. And we do this through a range of programmes of work focusing on civil service, on government, on the constitution, but also on the devolved settlement and how well that's working. In each case, we really focus not on policies, but on processes. So how well the processes of government work, and is there anything we can do to make it work better?
That's great. So that's very topical, I think, because I think what's happened over the last year in particular has thrown some light on some issues, maybe with the interaction between the different governments of the UK. And we've been struck in Scotland, I think, in the last few years in particular, in terms of the interdependencies between the kind of budgetary setting processes in both sets of parliaments. So from your perspective, in terms of the departments and the parliament that you're dealing with at Westminster, how well understood do you think it is that you know the devolved budget processes and how reliant they might be on sort of what's done at Westminster?
So I think the awareness of how it is supposed to work and how it works in practice is pretty high in government departments. I think the Treasury is well aware of what the setup is and how it's working, and indeed its advantages and disadvantages. I'm constantly surprised by how low, though, knowledge is in the Westminster Parliament, and indeed how little thought is sometimes given to some of the devolved implications of some of the policies which are being formulated in Westminster. I think, you know, I work a lot with select committees in Westminster who focus on different government departments. And there are, of course, also select committees that focus on Scotland, Scottish Affairs and Northern Ireland and Welsh Affairs, one committee for each. And they are very focused on the devolved nations and so on. But the other select committees pay relatively little attention, I'd say, to these sorts of issues. And I think it's a big area of focus that Westminster ought to think more about.
Yeah, because I think there was one inquiry recently that kind of hit that home, I think. It was into tax, and there was sort of no mention of devolution or the fact that some taxes were devolved, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, partly it's down to the members, partly it's down to the staff who work in the Westminster Parliament. It just is a big sort of Westminster centrism, if you like. And you know, I was also, you know, during the course of the Brexit process, happened to be talking to a backbench MP who is actually now a frontbench MP but will remain nameless, and I sort of said, he sort of said, oh, you know, how do you think it's all going? And one of the things I sort of mentioned in talking to him was that I was, you know, really troubled by the fact that the Sewell, you know, the way the Sewell Convention had been playing out, and that Scotland had not given legislative consent for a piece of legislation, and he was completely unaware that that had happened. You know, for me, you know, thinking about the constitution of the UK and how it works, it was a big deal, but he was completely oblivious. And, you know, when I told him about it, he was concerned, but it really struck me as a bit alarming that Westminster can pass legislation without being aware that, for example, Scottish Parliament hasn't given consent.
Yeah, and for those who might not know, can you just say what the Sewell Convention is?
So it's the convention that the Westminster Parliament will not normally legislate without the consent of the devolved parliaments. And the key in this is the not normally. And in the context of Brexit, the UK government decided that it was not normal and that it would go ahead and legislate. But it used to be just a convention. Then it was put into legislation, but it was put into legislation in those terms. So the not normally phrase, and that's the key get out clause, if you like, for the Westminster Parliament. They can continue to legislate even if they don't have consent. And that, I think, is, you know, that arose over Brexit, and I think is something which continues to be unresolved. I mean, I'm interested in your view, Mary, of how that went down.
Yeah, I guess it was, you know, the Parliament obviously weren't very pleased, and it's happened a few times now where consent hasn't been given, and it seems like not normally is becoming fairly frequent. And it obviously, you know, most recent tensions were in the legislative sense were around the internal market bill. And, you know, that will continue to cause issues, I think, as we move into exiting the transition period. But there's been a few different things, I think, this year which have brought these tensions, sort of intergovernmental or interparliamentary tensions to the fore. And on the government side, I suppose, there's been so many policy announcements about large-scale government intervention in order to support businesses, which has led to, you know, really fast changes in the policy environment, changes to taxation on stamp duty, for example, and, you know, massive announcements on business rates relief, which have knock-ons for the devolved governments. And I think this has highlighted some of the issues that happen when there isn't communication between the UK government and devolved governments about that these announcements are going to take place. So a couple of times in Scotland, for example, we saw Kate Forbes asked immediately what she was going to spend this consequential money on, for example, business rates relief on budget day in March. And she was like, well, I've just seen this. I, just like you all have, I don't actually know how much money we're getting yet exactly. And I need time to work that through. And similarly, when there was a stamp duty cut in England, she was expected to say immediately what they were going to do. And she said, well, we've got a different system. There's a different, you know, range of property prices here. I need to consider it, and so she should, but she was under a lot of pressure to do something quite quickly. One thing that's going to be highlighted this year, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. COVID has made these, what the Scottish government would probably, the Parliament would probably say, a long-standing sort of difficulties with the process a lot more visible. I think there have been, you know, the examples you highlight, in terms of business rates, stamp duty in particular, really did put the Scottish government in a difficult position, because those are sort of market sensitive policies, and it's not like you can pause and reflect and think for a long time about whether you're going to do the same thing. You know, there's pressure being put on you. You know, it would be really desirable to be in a situation where there was sufficient trust between the governments that, you know, the Treasury could give notice to the Scottish Government of those sorts of major policy decisions ahead of time. But to be quite honest, there isn't that level of trust within the UK government, because the Treasury doesn't tell ministers until the morning of the budget about some tax policies. So, you know, the Treasury holds these things extremely close. But that is not good for tax policy making in the UK either. So it would be much better for there to be more scrutiny around the tax policy making, which is completely different to general policy making process in terms of consultation and wider awareness of what's being proposed. And I think, you know, so that needs to be sorted out in Westminster. Then, you know, the next step on would be to say, you know, there should be more trust and a system where there would be more notice given to the Scottish Government. But I think the other thing we've seen And this comes down to politics, not ideal administrative process. But the other thing we've seen in the context of COVID, when the First Minister was involved in some of the COBRA meetings early on in the crisis, then, she came out and briefed some of, the things that had clearly been discussed a little bit ahead of when the UK government was planning to, and that clearly sort of rankled. And I think the UK government would say, well, if we tell the Scottish government some of this really sensitive stuff in advance, what guarantees do we have that, that won't happen in that context? So it really is an undesirable, political situation we find ourselves in, which is not good for policy outcomes, either within the UK or for Scotland in terms of how much time people have to reflect on what's being proposed.
Yeah, because I think, we touched on how things like legislative consent not being given sort of flies up here, and what the attitude is of, for example, the Parliament. And I think both in that and the fact that the UK government sort of chooses not to have a budget, but for understandable reasons, but that the lack of recognition of the impact that will have on the whole budgetary setting makes it very difficult. For example, Kate Forbes doesn't know just now if the UK government's going to continue rates relief for hospitality industries past March. And if they decide to do that, then obviously she'll get consequential funding to be able to do it in Scotland. So she has to make a decision at the moment about whether she can commit to that or not. And that's a really difficult one because she has to set that balanced budget. So
I think that's exactly right. And I think, the wider problem that that COVID has illustrated around policy making of all sorts is just about this predictability. For every small business, if you don't know until the very last minute if the furlough scheme is going, to continue, or if you're going to be in what tier you're going to be in, whatever, it makes planning really difficult. And I think everyone is experiencing this. I think in terms of the budgetary process generally, the Treasury, to try to defend them a bit, has tried to put some sort of floors on, amounts of money that the nations are going to get, and there is an argument that in terms of budget planning, the Scottish government shouldn't ever be sort of, planning to spend right up to the very limits of everything, so that there should always be some leeway. And so if it's a bit one way or a bit the other way, then actually that shouldn't be so much of a problem for the Scottish government. But I think in the context that we're in now, where actually the money is huge, the situation is changing so quickly, it does really demonstrate the difficulties of the way things are organised at the moment.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. The funding guarantees, for example, that the Treasury gave was kind of unprecedented, and it's got it's not got very much coverage, although we've talked about it quite a lot. But that was, that was a big concession, I suppose, in terms of guaranteeing the amount of funding, which was a kind of interesting movement, even though obviously they're not keen for fiscal flexibilities or allowing the government to borrow or anything. They did make that concession, which was obviously quite an important one. And it'll be interesting to see if that sort of sets a precedent for any future crises we have, which I'm sure we will at some point.
And I think that is something for us all to reflect on. There's a situation we've been forced into in many ways. And I think about this a lot in terms of the parliaments of the UK, what we've been forced to try in this context. Some part of our brain says to us, we just want to go back to how everything was before. But actually there are things which will be worth keeping and reflecting on the value of, and we need to take the time to not just sort of revert to the status quo, but say, actually, that worked quite well. And it didn't fall apart when we, when the Treasury gave that guarantee, or the Westminster Parliament had select committees meeting remotely or whatever it was. So there is some value in the things that have been forced upon us through the COVID pandemic, I think.
And I suppose we can't talk about the sort of the way that the governments across the UK work together without talking about Brexit, unfortunately. And I've already touched on the internal markets bill, and obviously there's been a lot of shall we say, politicking around this in terms of how much it actually does encroach on devolved issues and how much it's about giving powers to Scottish Parliament or taking them away. So for those who might not be familiar of the sorts of issues around it, could you just sort of outline what the main sort of sticking points are from a devolved government point of view?
Well, I'll set them out as far as I know, and then you can tell me whether you think I'm right. So one of the things that the Internal Market Bill does is gives the UK government new powers to spend money in devolved areas, things like infrastructure and cultural activities, without the agreement of the devolved administrations. And I think the expectation is that the money that used to, you know, come from the EU for those sorts of things, which is now going to be the shared prosperity funds, that's how that will be allocated. But the bill also amends the devolution statutes. So it says that the regulation of harmful subsidies is a reserved matter for the UK government, and there's a big disagreement on that, because the UK government says that's just a clarification of what was always the situation, but the Scottish and Welsh governments have argued that actually that was something that was devolved, so that's a challenge to legislate to say that. So yeah, I think those are probably the main issues.
Yeah, because the Shared Prosperity Fund is an interesting one, because obviously a lot of the funds that were spent, and my understanding is anyway, you know, through the EU structural funds and so on, you know, there was a lot of working with local government and that sort of thing in order to, put these projects in place. And exactly how it will be distributed and how it will work doesn't seem entirely clear to me anyway at the moment, and what the criteria will be for the dispersal funds isn't clear either, and I know obviously the devolved governments will be nervous about spending in devolved areas without consultation with them.
Yeah, I mean, and I can completely understand that, and I think I'm not sure the UK government knows yet how that's going to work. It's not only the rest of us that don't know. I mean, it seems to me, again, this is about politics. You know, this is about Westminster thinking, how can we prove the value of, you know, the current setup to the people of Scotland and Wales? And perhaps if we badge some of the spending, which happens through our settlement as UK government spending, that will make people feel more warm and cuddly about the UK government. And more attached to the union. I think it's a nice theory. I think they ought to reflect on the extent to which, you know, EU funding, as you rightly said, through structural funds, you know, arrived in the UK and was badged as EU money, and whether that made any difference to what the English certainly felt about the EU. Doesn't seem to have had a positive impact, even though actually, you know, the UK overall did quite well out of structural funds, particularly initially. So I think it's, you know, it's fairly transparent what it's about. It's caused a lot of tension, I think, intergovernmental tension. Whether it will be worth it is a big question, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the moment, obviously, the UK government are still negotiating over what the situation might be on the 1st of January. But no matter what they agree, or if they don't agree something, things are going to change, obviously, and there'll be lots. There's probably going to be a bit of disruption while people get used to these new customs declarations, or, you know, getting used to how we're going to trade with Northern Ireland, what the crossing will be like from Stranraer, for example, isn't quite clear yet, and exactly how it's all going to work. But I wonder what your thoughts are on what the involvement might be of devolved governments going forward. So, for example, if there's, you know, trade agreements that are made with particular countries when, you know, it's particular products that are important, which are maybe primarily produced in one of the devolved nations, you know, or something like that. You know, do you think that there's a possibility that there could be involvement from the devolved governments in these sorts of negotiations?
Well, I would certainly hope so, and I hope that that thought is being given to that. the precedents aren't that brilliant. And you know, one of the things that I think about in my work is also the involvement of the parliaments, and that's both the Westminster Parliament, but also the Scottish Parliament and the Welsh Parliament, and the Northern Ireland Assembly. You know, the extent to which the legislatures can scrutinise these deals when they've been reached is extremely limited. I mean, it's limited in Westminster. It's even more limited in the devolved nations. So I think that is a problem. I think one of the fundamental issues is Brexit has been done at such speed because of the Article 50 process, but also through political choice. The current government could have taken longer over negotiating the current deal had it wished to, but I think just as the EU wanted to put time pressure on the UK during the Article 50 process, so the UK felt that time pressure might be helpful to get a deal from the EU in the transition period. But everything has been done at such speed that actually the time available to take on different viewpoints has just not been there, and it's enabled the government to say, well, there just isn't time, so we're not going to do it. To the extent that, you know, and there has been consultation, but, you know, to the extent that people might wish. And I think that's just a bit worrying, because we've set precedents in this process, which then, you know, I think, for example, my example being the role of legislatures in the process of coming to new sort of trade deals, international agreements and so on, is limited. And that's the precedent we've set. And it would have been much more desirable for the first time round to do it really well, to think about whether the way that we do this, to think about the ideal process for it, and not to be doing it for the first time, and arguably, you know, the most important time in our deal with the EU, in a way which is so time pressured that you can't then think about the best way to do it.
Yeah, and it's you know, the folk will suffer from the decision being made so late in the day, with little preparation, or businesses who are going to have to figure out what they're doing over Christmas probably, many of whom will have been probably not had very much bandwidth this year to think about possibilities for Brexit, might not have a lot of cash to stockpile their, you know, supplies or anything like that, it might be quite a difficult few months for businesses who trade quite a lot with the EU. And in Scotland, we're obviously quite worried about businesses that produce, for example, shellfish, who need to trade quickly with the EU, and need to sell it into the market quickly so it's still fresh. And we just don't consume those things in this country as much, or we don't, certainly not enough. So it is, they could be sort of collateral damage of the sort of late decision on exactly how it's going to work.
Yeah, I think it's very problematic. But in some ways, you know, now that we're here, I realised that this was always where we were going to be. You know, I might have thought earlier in the year that, you know, we might have come to a deal in time for the proper ratification processes, and, you know, the European Parliament to look at the process, and our parliaments to look at the deal and so on. But actually, that was never going to be how it was, because both sides had to show it was going down to the wire. And, you know, let us hope we do end up with a deal. But either way, neither of them could allow it to be perceived that there was anything they could have done other than reach the deal, whatever the deal might be that they reach, or perhaps they won't. But you know, now there does seem an inevitability to it, and I hope that at least having had the transition period, businesses will have had a little bit more time to prepare for what might come.
Absolutely, that's a really good note to end on, and thank you so much for joining me today, Hannah. It's been fascinating talking about all this, and we'll see how things unfold over the next couple of weeks to see if we will get a deal, and see how we businesses get on in the first few months of next year. So, if you're interested in any more analysis on any of these issues, on the budget, on the impact of COVID on the Scottish economy, and much more, you'll find plenty of commentary and analysis at fraserofallander.org. You can subscribe to our podcasts through all the major podcast platforms. And around our economic commentary, we put out a few podcasts this week, so look out for those if you're interested. Thanks for listening, and thanks again to our guest, Dr. Hannah White from the Institute for Government.
Thank you for having me.
We'll see you again soon for another Fraser Vallander podcast.